This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And Meghna, you're looking well-rested today.
Well, thank you.
But let me ask you, are you? Do you get enough sleep?
I'd say, yeah, most of the time I think I do.
You think you do. And on those nights that you don't get enough sleep, what are the reasons for that?
Well, until relatively recently, it was my toddler who was still trying to learn how to sleep through the night. But I'm ashamed to admit it, but I will. Recently, it's been my iPad and the Netflix app.
Ooh, iPad. Okay. Well, whether it's toddlers, babies, iPads, it turns out we are a nation of insomniacs. That's according to a number of recent studies, including one from the National Sleep Foundation that found that more than 60% of Americans complain of sleep problems every night, whether it's getting too little sleep, trouble falling asleep, or waking up too early and feeling unrested for most of the day.
And the problem goes well beyond people feeling a bit bleary-eyed. Too little sleep is associated with a host of serious health problems, including traffic accidents, depression, cancer, heart disease, even obesity. And because Boston is a center of student life, of busy academics and ambitious professionals, not to mention hardworking and overextended mothers and fathers, Anthony, we thought it would be worth spending a little time talking about sleep.
In a moment, we're going to be talking about your sleep problems and what to do about them, how to fall asleep, how to stay asleep, and whether you're getting enough sleep. But first, Michelle George joins us. She's wellness coordinator at Boston University and runs the Got Sleep Workshops at BU, which studies common sleep issues and offers advice to students and faculty. And Michelle George, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what's the most common complaint you hear at your Got Sleep workshops?
So for most students, they're always complaining about, you know, not being able to get the 8 to 9 hours that's recommended because they don't have time. And not only that, but also that they just feel exhausted every day and stressed out and things like that. So,
and is this a problem in your view, the challenge of too little sleep, of always feeling exhausted, getting worse? And if so, what accounts for it?
I think it's a little of both. I think, one, students overcommit themselves. And so, you know, all of these great things come along. Oh, I want to do this. I want to do that. This looks good. And so the time management is a problem. But in addition, I feel like there's not so much guidance towards the importance of sleep. You know, people don't really look at it as a priority.
And talk about the importance of getting enough sleep. What are some of the health issues associated with too little sleep?
Okay, so lots of things. The first and foremost, as it regards to students, is that they talk about how when you're during sleep is when your memory goes from short-term to long-term. So for students who are staying up all night studying for an exam, the likelihood of them remembering that material past 12 hours after they wake up is pretty slim to none. In addition, that's the time when your body repairs its damage throughout the day. So if you do have any stress throughout the day or anything like that, that's not getting repaired.
Now, you mentioned, of course, here at BU, you see lots of students, and I gather one of the big concerns, and you sort of made reference to this, is how many of them will pull those all-nighters, mm-hmm. perhaps to study for a test. We've all done it. Sometimes it seems like it's the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. But is the all-nighter a good way to actually cram information into your head for a test, for example?
Yeah, so some people have said that, you know, X numbers of less sleep than you're supposed to get. So say you get 6 hours of sleep instead of 8. That's like drinking one beer. And they just kind of go up as the number of hours increases that you've lost sleep. The second thing that's definitely noticeable is focus. Mm. The ability to focus when you're tired or exhausted is diminished, certainly. And I think, you know, college students and adults alike can agree with that.
So the all-nighter, not a good idea. What do you suggest instead?
So what I usually do is I say, okay, everybody's got 24 hours. So take out 8 for sleep. Now you have 16. What are you going to do with it?
Well, whether you're a college student or a working professional or doing something else, life can always be stressful. Falling asleep can be tricky for a lot of people. That plays into getting enough sleep. What's your best advice? What do you counsel in your workshop?
Definitely having the routine is important. Trying to go to sleep at the same time every night, waking up at the same time every morning, watching how much caffeine you take in. Caffeine, sugar, taurine, guarana, all of those things keep us awake, stimulate our bodies and minds. And then, of course, trying to get away from the screen an hour or so before you want to go to bed. Screens are very stimulating.
So the computer screen, the iPad screen, the smartphone screen.
All those things are visually stimulating, so they kind of keep your brain awake. The second thing is that with screens, a lot of times you're checking an email or maybe looking at Facebook and you'll see a post or an email that upsets you emotionally in some way, and that's going to keep you up. So the more you avoid those things right before bed, the less common that problem might be.
Some sensible ideas there from Michelle George. She's wellness coordinator at Boston University. She runs the Got Sleep Workshops at BU, which studies common sleep issues. Michelle George, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
So listeners, do you get the sleep that you need? If not, why not? And if you had sleep problems and managed to solve them, can you pass along some tips? Or do you have questions about strategies for better sleep, whether they involve exercise, less coffee, or more pills? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston.
So we're talking about our increasingly elusive relationship with Morpheus. And to help guide us, we're joined now by Dr. Sandra Horowitz. She's the founding president of the Mass Sleep Society, a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School Division of Sleep Medicine, associate professor of neurology at University of Massachusetts. And Sandra Horowitz, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Does it seem to you like this problem is getting worse? And if so, why? And I'm thinking, you know, we just heard Michelle George talking about things like iPads, Facebooks. Meghna mentioned iPads keeping her awake at night. Does this explain why this seems to be a growing problem for millions of Americans?
I think there are many things that are contributing to the fact that we're not getting enough sleep. We're not paying enough attention to the need for sleep in our daily lives. And we have so much stresses, so much media available to us, and we have not become very good at turning off that media when it's available.
Right. Really turning things off and creating a sort of sanitized zone around our sleep, right? I guess that's important.
We use things in our environment to let us know when it's time to be active, when it's time to sleep, light and dark cycles, eating cycles, rest and activity cycles. But when you think of the computer and Facebook and Twitter, they're really designed not to have a 24-hour cycle, just like gambling in Las Vegas.
What do we understand about sleep and what do we not understand? Obviously, we know that we need to sleep for all kinds of reasons, but do we really understand what's going on in the body about in terms of why we need to sleep?
There are many essential functions in the body that require sleep in order to reconstitute themselves. Our blood pressure goes down, our heart rate slows down, our brains are in a slower state of activity, our brainwaves go from alpha activity to slow waves. And it's an important time for us to allow us to recharge our batteries, basically.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the health effects. I mean, obviously, those of us who suffer occasionally from sleeplessness, there are all kinds of issues that are easy to identify right off the top. I mean, nervousness, higher levels of stress, and so forth. But the health effects really go deeper than that, don't they?
They go significantly deeper. There's a good way to think about sleep disturbances is to think about either people who don't get enough sleep, people who are chronically tired, they always want more sleep, people who do strange things during their sleep, and people who sleep at the wrong times. So many things can happen to disturb our sleep.
Right. And in terms of more seriously chronic diseases, like cancers, for example, I mean, I was surprised to read today that a chronic loss of sleep, there's actually a connection to diseases like cancer. How does that work? And how serious is that?
There's thought that there may be some inflammatory markers that are important, but also they have looked at night shift workers and found that they may have a higher incidence of predisposition to some cancers. Exactly what the mechanism is something that we're far from understanding completely.
Right. But another indication that getting the sleep you need is important. And when it comes to that, Sandra Horowitz, how much sleep do we need? Because we always hear the sort of magic number, 8 hours. I was told by a sleep expert quite a while ago that it's important to know how much sleep you need as an individual. That some people might need 8. Some people might do just fine with 4.5. Some people might need 10.
Well, if you think of it basically as the proverbial normal curve, 7.8 is kind of at the peak. Mm-hmm. And that's what we would call the median. And about 5% of people need 2 hours more, and 5% of people need 2 hours less. A major change in our sleep habits occurred actually about just over 100 years ago when they first invented the light bulb. We actually slept an hour more before that happened.
Fascinating. So the light bulb, obviously, because it keeps the room lighter, so people stay up more. And that seems related as well to the whole conversation about the iPad and FaceTime and that sort of stuff. Same idea, right?
Yes.
Speaking of the way we used to sleep, I wanted to ask you about this. I came across a fascinating article about a study out of Virginia Tech that rounded up a bunch of research that suggested that a long, long time ago, we used to sleep in chunks, that people didn't necessarily sleep all the way through the night in 7 or 8 hour chunks, but that the natural sort of human approach to sleep was to sleep in 2, 3, 4, or 5 hour chunks. Is there any truth to that? Do we know? Does that tell us anything useful about how we sort of naturally approach sleep?
Our lifestyles may have been very different thousands of years ago, and we had to be much more aware of dangers that could approach at any time when our civilization was more primitive than it is now. Really, today we have much more emphasis on having a larger sleep chunk. Some people can do napping during the day, and that can help them reconstitute themselves and be more functional during the day. But for the most part, we need to sleep in one large chunk at night.
We're talking about our increasingly difficult relationship with sleep, and we're joined by Dr. Sandra Horowitz. She's the founding president of the Mass Sleep Society, and you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're asking if you get the sleep you need, and if not, why not? And we're looking for strategies to help people who might be looking for ways to get more and better sleep. And we've already got a bunch of calls on the line, so let's go to them right now. Paul is calling from Watertown. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Well, I'm 62, and I just fairly suddenly started to have trouble sleeping. I was waking up in the middle of the night a few months ago, and a lot of issues I thought about, including the getting away from screens. That seems like a great, helpful hint. But one is exercise. But one thing is I just happened to be driving here from Whole Foods. I just bought some melatonin. I tried some low-dosage melatonin for about a week now, and it sort of seems to help somewhat. And I'm just sort of wondering if, you know, you recommend melatonin at all or what with that.
Okay, Paul, thanks for the question. Let's put that to Sandra Horowitz. Melatonin, I know this is a popular thing. You see it at a lot of health food stores. Good idea?
It's safe. It's a hormone. It has relatively low side effects, and it's relatively well tolerated. However, when they have done randomized controlled trials about using it purely as a sedative, it really hasn't shown to be that effective. It's much more effective in people who have shift work sleep disorders or jet lag sleep disorders. But when I think that many of the things that we use for sleep have a large placebo effect, mm-hmm. and sometimes believing it's going to help will help just in and of itself. Sure. We produce our own melatonin in response to dim light. Whenever the lights go down at night, we start to produce melatonin. It tends to peak around midnight and then decrease towards the morning time.
What about other treatments? And I'm talking specifically about drugs. Lots of commercials on the airwaves for drugs like Lunesta, for Ambien, where I sort of feel bombarded by them in the evening, as a matter of fact. Are they effective? What precautions do people need to take?
These drugs are a specific class of medications, and they're thought to be less habit-forming. They're not supposed to be physiologically addictive, but anything that we get used to doing every night can have some psychologic dependency build up. They're effective. They help us to get to sleep, and they can help us to stay asleep. And for occasional use, they can be very useful tools. To use them every night, you're going to get used to it, and then when you stop it, you may have a rebound insomnia that puts you behind where you were in the first place. Mm.
I've used in the past, it's been quite some time that I've tried them because I didn't like the effect, Ambien. And the feeling that I got was the pills would put me to sleep without any trouble. I wouldn't stay asleep very long. And the quality of sleep that I got didn't feel to be particularly restorative. I don't know if there's any sort of medical explanation for that or if that was just my peculiar reaction to it.
It's not that uncommon that people have a tendency to have that medication wear off after 3 or 4 hours. Yeah. However, many people feel that they actually get a better quality of sleep than normal.
Interesting. Huh.
There have been some instances as well of people having sleepwalking events or sometimes waking up in a confused state after they've taken sleep medications.
Interesting. Let's take another call. Maggie is calling from Alston. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you doing? And what's on your mind?
I work at night most nights. I have kind of an erratic work schedule. I normally can work until 3 a.m., and then sometimes I have to go in at work at 10:30 a.m. So I have like a seven-hour chunk between my schedule, but it's hard to sort of get on a sleep schedule at all. Is 6 hours enough, or... It's kind of hard for me to set up a schedule. It can be the same weekly, but not daily.
Sure. So your sleep schedule, Maggie, you actually have to sort of change it throughout the week. Sandra Horowitz, what's the best advice for Maggie there?
I think it is a good idea to have one chunk of time that you sleep, but it's important that the room is dark and quiet. It's more difficult to do during the day. And we know that people do best if they have a variable shift, if they're going to advance their clock forward, and if they have enough time to adjust to it. It really takes about 8 to 10 days to adjust to every change. If you're changing too frequently or don't have any set schedule, then it's more difficult to adjust to.
Well, Maggie, thanks for the call, and we wish you good luck. Let's take another call. Lynn is calling from Billerica. Hey, Lynn.
Hi.
You're on the air. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say that when my husband and I got married, I spent the first 12 years not sleeping very well because I would feel him roll over or wake up or go to the bathroom. I'm a light sleeper. And so we adopted one of our friends' way of sleeping. They're from Sweden, and in many parts of Europe, the couples have their own sheets and blankets so that you don't share a common sheet, which sometimes, you know, the person might be fighting for it. And then also what we've done is we have a king-size bed, but it's two separate twin mattresses so that we each get our own rest, and I'm not feeling him rolling over and he's not feeling me wiggling around either. So that's been it's really helped us. I've slept better in the last 4 years than I have the last 16. So,
well, Lynn, we're grateful for that. We're grateful for that suggestion, the Scandinavian method, so sleeping together but separately. Is this something that comes up, Sandra Horowitz, among couples who you see or talk to about this stuff?
Well, the sleep of one part of a couple always influences the other. And
sure.
Usually it's a complaint by the wife that the husband is snoring that brings them in to the office. And that's one of the commonest reasons to go to a sleep center.
I wouldn't know anything about that. Okay, so that's a common reason to go to a sleep center. Lynn, we appreciate the call. Let's go to Evan from Sharon. Hi, Evan.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well.
So I exercise quite a bit, and I try to maintain a fairly consistent sleep schedule. But my thing is that I always go to bed, you know, around 11, 12 o'clock. I have school as well. I recently purchased, like, a Tempur-Pedic pillow to try to sleep better. But I don't know, like, I always wake up tired. And every day I kind of still go through the motions, and some days I give myself more rest than others. But, you know, the main thing is I always wake up tired, and I'm wondering why my body doesn't want to let me sleep more to kind of recover from, you know, my exercise or my stress from the previous day.
Sandra Horowitz.
I think it's important to pay attention to when you exercise. It's important that you exercise early in the day and not too close to your bedtime, because you don't want to raise your metabolic rate just before it's time to go to sleep. And it's important that you have a reasonable, restful evening routine before you get to sleep. And I think that would help you sleep more efficiently.
Evan, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Bruce, who's calling from Topsfield. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, good afternoon. My question is regarding the effect of noise at nighttime. I live on Main Street. And I've heard anecdotally through store studies that it can be extrapolated into affecting dementia for older people. Can too much road noise or other kind of noises that can interrupt the sleep cycle be harmful?
Bruce, it's a really good question. Sandra, what do we say to Bruce?
Well, I think noise is an important factor. First of all, they're two separate issues. Noise is something that we have a hard time adjusting to. And if you look at people's brain waves when they're sleeping, people who live by airports, even when they say they can sleep through the fact that planes are flying overhead at odd intervals, every time a plane goes overhead, we see an activation of brainwave activity. So noise is a considerable factor. Getting enough sleep, on the other hand, is a very good way to help protect ourselves as we get older. It is a good idea to have, it's one of our healthful habits that we can do as a specific preventer of dementia. Really maintaining good oxygenation, not having sleep apnea, are things that can help us to prevent cognitive decline as we get older.
When it comes to sleep and sleeping well and getting the sleep we need, what are there genetic factors that determine this? In other words, if your mother and father were very good sleepers, are you going to necessarily be a good sleeper?
There's many sleep disturbances that run in families. Insomnia tends to run in families. Sleep apnea runs in families. Sleepwalking tends to run in families. So there certainly are genetic factors.
Let's try to get at least one or two more calls in here. Carolyn is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Carolyn.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Very well.
I wanted to add that my son was Ferberized in, 1992, and he would get up at 5:30 a.m. every day. And he is now completing his first year in college and still getting up at 5:30 a.m. every day. We just took him to a sleep doctor at Mass General, and he basically told us that this should serve our son as a blessing because he has such a powerful internal sleep clock and that there's probably no changing it. And I just wondered if the doctor had any thoughts on someone who has such a profound internal clock, is there any changing it if someone wants to sleep longer but can't because 5:30, just he's up.
Sure.
Even on Saturdays and Sundays at college.
Oh, boy.
Usually we come across the opposite problem in college students and teenagers where they go to bed too late and cannot get up in the morning. So that may be why they said it was a blessing. However, you can change it. It has to be done very gradually. It has to be done systematically. And there has to be significant supports with the environment and a strong will on the part of the patient. There has to be a shift from the motivation from the parent side to the patient side.
Carolyn, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. Dr. Horowitz, I want to ask you a sort of a general question about the way we're educated about sleep. We heard at the beginning of our segment with our guest from BU, from the Got Sleep program. She suggested that we probably still don't do a good enough job educating people about the importance of sleep and doing what's necessary to get the sleep we need. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think it's something that we don't pay a lot of attention to. We don't even pay enough attention to it in medical school when we're educating doctors, and I think we should pay a lot more attention to it. At sleep health centers where I work, we send a lot of people out into the community and schools to give lectures to people about sleep, and I think that increases awareness. There's a lot of articles in the popular media, and that seems to be where people get a lot of information about sleep.
It's so strange that we don't impart that message, given that sleep is something that all of us do every day. Isn't it strange? Dr. Sandra Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's Sandra Horowitz. She's the founding president of the Massachusetts Sleep Society and a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School's Division of Sleep Medicine. And listeners, you can keep this conversation going online. Anon Sleeper writes on RadioBoston.org, "When I was in college, there was a little stigma attached to getting enough sleep. Kids who got 8 hours of sleep a night were thought to be not working hard enough or weren't partying hard enough. I almost always got 8 hours. That was just how I operate, but I do remember feeling peer pressure to live with less sleep." So the conversation continues on RadioBoston.org. Stay with us up next, why being blacklisted in Hollywood isn't so bad anymore. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.